Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte. Episode 47 for November 21st, 2008. Mifos.
This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
It's time for Floss Weekly, free Libre open source software in all its varied guises. Back from his cruise, his visit to the Alexandria Library, and more, Randall Schwartz is here.
Hey, Leo.
We missed you. Ramble.
Good to be back in the States, sleeping in my own bed for a couple of days. Although I got to say, you know, the big cushy beds in those cabins on the cruise ship were just wonderful. Except I worked real, real hard trying to find the exact combination of pillows to keep my arm elevated while I was asleep.
Right.
Because as people know who are listening to the show last time, you know, I had just broken my arm and I wasn't sure whether I was going to go on Mac Mania 8 or not. And it was right down to the wire, right down to like the Saturday. I was flying out Sunday morning. Saturday afternoon, by then, I had gone through surgery. I had a plate put in my arm, a lot of drugs. Spent the next day totally in misery. But I packed my bag Saturday and walked around the house for 15 minutes with them just to make sure that I could actually get through the airports. And I've got to say, the rehearsal was good because it confirmed that at least I'd be able to get out and back to the cruise ship. The only problem I really had is one night I woke up thinking that I had a dream that my left arm had somehow bumped into a piece of electrical equipment, and I was trying to pull it away from the electrical equipment. And when I woke up, my left arm was banging the headboard.
Oh,
and I didn't sleep. I was like in the first 2 hours, I didn't sleep the rest of that night, and I had a presentation to make the next morning. So it was super trooper time.
Who was on the cruise with you? It was Mac Mania 8, so besides a bunch of Mac fanatics.
David Pogue was there. Bebo White. Bebo actually, believe it or not, this is great. Bebo was invited by special invitation to go to the Alexandria Museum, or not museums, Alexandria Library.
Library, yeah.
To speak specially, because he's a big internet star. Because he was going there, we got to hang out with him and do a behind-the-scenes tour and go through the Egyptian Antiquities adjacent museum within the library. Wow. The library is phenomenal. Oh, it's if you can see some of the pictures in my Flickr stream of the architecture inside this giant, like a football field-sized building inside the building.
Yeah.
And it's designed to have indirect sunlight the entire day, and so it's nice diffuse light and. Oh, it's just a beautiful building, and it was really fun getting to go there. As far as I got into Egypt, I couldn't take the long trips out to the pyramids, so didn't get to see those. But at least I got to see the library. But I went there, and they said, "Hey, you're Merlin, right?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "You got a book that's 2,000 years overdue." So
that'll be $8 million in fines.
Drachmas, come
drachmas.
On, or whatever. Whatever's in Egypt. Sorry, I have no idea. Anyway. But it, wonderful trip. Glad I got to go.
I think they used dollars. I can't remember. Trying to remember.
And Don McAllister was on, and so he said hi, and since I just heard it on MacBreak Weekly the previous week, and so I got to see what he finally looked like. That was a lot of fun, and I gave four different presentations on podcasting and on gadgets on the Mac under $50, and really glad I got to go. It was a lot of fun, and it was stress, obviously, since I didn't have the use of my left arm the entire time. It was made a little tricky.
Now, this is a Costas cruise, right?
Costa,
of the past,
right.
we've done Holland America. How was the Costa? Holland America is so nice.
Yeah, it's really hard to compare anything to Holland. Holland's just been really good for us in terms of meeting space, in terms of food quality and coordination. And I will say, though, that in Costa's defense, the previous cruise we did with Costa 2 or 3 years ago, they originally had an entire Italian staff all the way from top to bottom. And based on the experiences with their sister organizations, Costa is also part of the Carnival Corp, they fired all those and replaced them with Indonesians, and now it's a whole lot better.
I love the Indonesians. I do. They the service staff on Holland America is also Indonesian, and they are
exactly
the greatest. Yeah.
And so it worked out really nice, and I got to eat in the Supreme Lounge a bunch of times, or the super dining area that was ate almost every night there. And just great. Great shows, excellent performances and everything. And of course, our staff was amazing. Oh, and also, in our group of 125, there were five orthopedic surgeons. So I was covered 24/7. I got better service there than I've gotten out of my own doctor here.
Now, you got a lot of pictures of the disco dance floor. Did you get to do any discoing?
No, I couldn't go around people because people kept backing up into me. I had to keep bracing with my other arm.
So you had to stand in the balcony and just take pictures.
All I got to do this time. I couldn't see my disco duck impression or anything. I did sing karaoke, though, so I sang The Piano Man. It was pretty fun, and I replaced a few of the words with a few other words. It made it a lot more fun for the multilingual.
Sing me a song, I'm der Piano Spiegel.
Yes, exactly. And so it was great. I didn't get off on the first two ports because I was so jet-lagged and so having trouble sleeping with my arm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I got off first got off in Egypt, and it was just great. And then I got off at every port after that, including Catacalone. I'd been there before. The one just before that, I'm not looking at my sheet, so I can't tell where it was, but it's the crater that they think used to be Atlantis.
Wow.
And so there was this tram that goes right up the side of the hill. This is in Greece. Tram goes right up the side of the hill. Beautiful views, just clear, crisp air, just beautiful pictures. I wish I could take more pictures. All those pictures you see on the Flickr pages were taken with a Canon SD990IS with one hand.
Wow.
So all the controls are along the right-hand side.
Oh,
I was able to get to every single control.
Yeah.
So it's a good quality pictures anyway. I wish I would have had my 50D along with me, but couldn't do that. So I had to stay home.
Well, I hope you're feeling fine for our trip to China.
You know? I'm so geared up for that. Really want to go on that. A lot of the people on this cruise are on that one already.
Oh, you're kidding. Really?
Oh, yeah. Well,
there are regulars, aren't there? People who just cruise all
half,
the time.
Half of the 125 are previous cruisers.
You're kidding.
Our
that's
alumni
how,
lunch
that's
took
how
over
great,
like half the lunchroom.
That's
yeah.
how great these cruises are. I highly recommend you go to insightcruises.com.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to China. It'll be Mac Mania 9 for the Mac mm-hmm. aficionados. It'll be you, me. I think Don McAllister's going again. Andy Inotko from MacBook Weekly. It's going to be a lot of fun. And Neil's begging me. He's saying, what are you going to talk about? What are you going to talk about? So I have to come up with some lectures.
I'll let you do the podcasting talk this time. I've had a great time doing it the last three times. I do this little talk on how to get into podcasting. A lot of it's stuff I'm quoting directly from you. So,
yeah, you know what? You're stealing from the best. It's okay.
That and the thing under $50. Wasn't that one of your things, too? The Mac gadgets under
$50?
No, I don't
think so. That's a good one, though. I might steal that one for my talk.
We'll
figure it out. You can keep doing that one, and we'll figure it out. But we'd love to see you. We're going to China July 9th. And actually, I'm going to go to the land tour, which starts, I think, July 3rd, July 2nd or 3rd. So there's a week land tour. Then we're going to go see China. We're going to Japan and Korea. Can't wait. We'd love to have you aboard with us, insightcruises.com. And look at Randall's pictures. What is it, Stonehenge? What is your Flickr handle?
My Flickr handle is Randall-Schwartz. You couldn't make it up any easier than that.
Okay. So Flickr.com/Randall-Schwartz.
I think you have to say photos in there, too.
No, they dropped that, thank goodness.
Oh, really?
They finally got rid of that.
Okay.
It was always a pain. You can now just go Flickr.com and the name of the person, and it'll take you to photos/the name of the person, but at least it does that.
And we can, and also if you look at any one of the pictures, they're also part of a pool for all the other cruisers. We have about 10 people contributing to the pool already. So there's a lot of pictures in the Mac Mania 8 pool. You can just look for it under Mac Mania 8 under groups.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
So that's also available there, too. A lot more pictures than all that I took, because obviously I only got to a small number of shore excursions because of my arm. So
now, let's get to the open source part of the show.
Oh, the reason we're actually chatting today. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah. So we're going to talk today. I'm very excited about this. To a couple of guys from Mifos.
Mifos or Mifos, something like that. Microfinance Open Source. These guys contacted me. And I did some research for the show today, and it was just, I mean, I was, it just, it sounds complex. It sounds like they're building stuff that people can use to essentially make microloans. So, and they're building open source software to take care of all that, to take care of the infrastructure stuff, the how to keep track of the bookkeeping and, you know, whether people are going to get paid on time or not or something. And so it's, it sounds like it's going to be a pretty interesting show.
Very cool. Well, let's get our guests on. We've got, George Connard and Adam Monson. Adam, where are you?
I'm in Minneapolis.
And George Connard, where are you?
I'm out in Seattle.
Great. And you both are working on something called MIFOS.
That is right.
What is MIFOS?
So MIFOS is an initiative of the Grameen Foundation, which is a nonprofit here in the U.S. At its core, what we're doing is we're building an open source banking MIS system for microfinance institutions around the world, small institutions providing loans and other financial services to the very poor.
That's a real, I mean, look, first of all, let's just talk about microfinancing because it's new. I don't know how many people know about it, but it is really amazing and it's so effective at changing the world. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And microfinance it's actually been around for about 30 odd years at this point.
Has it really?
Started in a couple different places around the world. One of the people in our heritage, Professor Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh, started Grameen Bank in the mid 1970s.
Right.
Basically trying to break the cycle of the money lenders in Bangladesh, and these have been a problem in different places around the world where a poor person might have something that they could do to earn some money, but they don't have any capital to use. And so they have to go to a moneylender in the morning, maybe borrow 50 taka or 5 pesos if they're in the Philippines or wherever. And at the end of the day, go back and pay the moneylender back 60, and so you've got pretty, you calculate that out to an annual interest rate and it's just, in the gazillions or something like that. They're never able to get ahead. And so by giving them access to capital, which is really where micro lending started, you can let them get ahead of the game and become very entrepreneurial and find ways to make some money to help themselves get out of poverty. And, one of the incredible things about microfinance is that in lots of different places around the world, the poor are considered to be not credit worthy by commercial banks, but the repayment rates that you'll get out of these loans are in the range of 97, 98, 99% with no collateral, sometimes no legal documents, all of that. It's one of the most powerful tools and kind of the most proven tools that we've got in the fight against poverty around the world.
So Grameen started it, but I think many of us in the States first became aware of it with Kiva.org.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Kiva's been doing some great stuff over the last couple of years. They're taking an approach of trying to find ways to get individuals more involved in microfinance and finding ways to, for you or I to get our money working on something that helps microfinance institutions. So being able to kick in $25 or $100 or $1,000, whatever it is, and then Kiva can help aggregate that and get it out to the microfinance institutions so that they can lend it onto their poor clients.
So tell us how MIFOS gets involved. What is the role of MIFOS?
Yeah, absolutely. We started MIFOS at the Grameen Foundation here, actually in the Grameen Technology Center, which is based in Seattle, about 4 years ago. And it grew out of experience that we had working with MFIs, microfinance institutions, to get automated. One of the big problems that microfinance is facing right now is that as an industry, we're reaching, over 100, maybe 120, 130, 140 million people around the world, but there's still a couple of billion who aren't being reached. And so how we get microfinance to a much larger scale is an ongoing challenge. And one of the big barriers that they have is getting good automation in place so that they can effectively manage their operations, get some insight into what financial products are working. And there's a pretty big market failure in this space. It's not it's not the market where you've got Citibank and HSBC or Deutsche Bank who you're trying to sell to for hundreds of millions of dollars. And the systems and tools that are out there are often very inflexible, or they're kind of derived from the commercial banking space, don't work particularly well for microfinance institutions, and they're not particularly well supported in the places where microfinance is happening. You'll have somebody in Morocco who's trying to get support from somebody who's 10 time zones away and doesn't speak the same language. And we thought, based on our experience working with MFIs to deploy those systems, is there a different approach that we can take? And particularly given the diversity of different ways of doing microfinance, thinking about can we can we start an open source project, and can we get an open platform in place that MFIs and their local partners can use to effectively automate their operations, get some good business intelligence going, and do that in a way that breaks the cycle of MFIs not having access to technology and vendors not really wanting to serve them.
Is Grameen your first customer?
So Grameen Foundation here in the U.S. is actually a nonprofit that's behind the MIFOS initiative.
I see.
And Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which is a kind of a sister institution, they're a heritage, but not the same organization. They're a little bigger than we've wanted to tackle at first. They've got, you know,
hundreds of thousands of customers, right? I mean,
actually, I think they're up to about 8 million core clients that they're serving.
That's
right.
Really nice. And of course, Dr. Yes. Yunus and Grameen won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for this.
In 2006, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yunus and the Grameen Bank did. So we've been working over the last few years to build the platform, start building the community, and we have an MFI in Bangalore, India called Grameen Kuta, which is, when we started working with them, they had about 20,000 clients. They're now up pushing close to 200,000. They're the largest deployment of the system. They've got, I think, close to 75 branches up and running their business on it. Another smaller MFI in Nairobi in Kenya, and we've got two more, one in Tunisia, one in the Philippines, who are just in the last stages of their deployments. And we're at a stage now of trying to figure out how we throw some gas on the fire and really, you know, think about how we scale this up to dozens and eventually hundreds more institutions around the world.
Very cool.
Well, what's this replacing? I mean, there must be some existing software.
Yeah, what are they doing now?
Banks, yeah, small banks are using otherwise. Or are they doing it all on paper?
An abacus.
Sheets? Abacus? Yeah, there we go.
A lot of them, you know, it's pretty surprising. There are a lot of microfinance institutions that are managing their books manually today. And that, you know, by manual, I kind of lump together paper, and you'd be surprised at how many are doing them on paper. I mean, I've seen an MFI that's got 150,000 clients, and they're managing it all on paper.
Oh.
But lumped together paper and Excel kind of as manual. That's probably about 40% of the institutions that are out there today. Another 40% or so have crafted together custom systems. And that's, you know, they've hired somebody to build something for them, or they've kind of got an IT guy internally who's building something on a, you know, 13-year-old version of Fox Pro and trying to make that work. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that we took this approach, was seeing that a lot of MFIs were doing it themselves because they had unique needs, and thinking, but they're all building 90% the same thing. And then that last 10% is really the tailoring it. So can we get them something that, you know, meets that 90% bar, gets them some value immediately, and then they can work with either us or someone else to figure out how to tweak it to meet their needs. Then about 20% of the market is using other commercial off-the-shelf packages. And there are actually a couple dozen of them that are out there.
Is there an application for larger banks, or is this so dedicated to micro lending that it really wouldn't apply to other institutions?
Yeah, our focus really is on the microfinance institution and the unique needs that they have, and I'll give you an example of that in a minute. But commercial banks, even smaller to medium sized commercial banks, there are commercial offerings out there that, you know, anybody from a small bank in Rwanda all the way up to Citigroup and folks like that can use effectively. But there are some unique elements to microfinance that have made it difficult to use those commercial offerings. The most important of them, I think, is the group lending model. And this is something that was pioneered by Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, where a group of six women in microfinance, primarily serves women, although it's becoming more gender diverse. Six women in a village will get together and form a group. And the bank will often lend to them as a group, or the group will, in a lot of other cases, kind of co-insure each other's loans and say that we as a group are going to get behind all of our loans. And if one person is having trouble making their payment, the rest of us will find ways to get them there. And I think that's been one of that social network has been one of the most powerful things about microfinance. But that group lending model is something that's kind of hard to bolt onto a traditional banking application.
It's essentially like an insurance then, an insurance syndicate then, in some sense, because you've got a bunch of people all insuring each other's payments.
Sort of, yeah. And how that actually manifests varies from one microfinance institution to another. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's quite literally co-insuring or co-guaranteeing each other's loans. In other cases, it's not that formal, where the rest of the group isn't necessarily held on the hook for one person's loan, but they're, as a group, deciding whether or not this person is in a position where they should receive the loan in a certain amount, and they have more visibility being in the village with them into whether or not they're going to be able to repay it. A lot of MFIs are also starting to get into individual lending, not doing a group lending model, particularly for poor clients who are maybe less poor than the poorest out in rural villages, are in a position where they can, you know, they have an existing business and they're ready to kind of break out of the group model, but aren't quite ready to graduate onto full-on commercial lending.
Must be a different kind of challenge to do this because support is going to be very different. You may not have sophisticated users. Did you have to design the project a little differently because of how it's going to be used?
Absolutely. And I think that falls into a couple of different categories. And you hit one of them. The support model for what we're trying to do is very interesting, and it's very challenging. I mean, essentially what we're talking about is a pretty hardcore financial transaction processing and business intelligence system. It's essentially enterprise software in fairly small institutions in the developing world that haven't had a lot of experience with technology before. And the local partners that are in place are, you know, very eager and in a lot of cases have very smart people with a lot of skills, but haven't done a lot of this before.
Right.
And the industry as a whole has seen a lot of systems implementations just gone bad, you know, $1 million sunk into it over the course of a couple of years and still not having an effective system. So in addition to building the technology well, which is an important part of the second piece of the equation, we have to find a model that allows for support to be, you know, given locally, delivered locally to the MFIs, and it doesn't require them to have a lot of, you know, super high skilled IT people on staff, because the cost model for that gets very difficult. And the underlying economics of how this gets done and how, you know, how do you spread out the cost of building the technology in an effective way across institutions that may not have a lot of money to spend is as hard or in some ways harder, I think, than building the technology itself.
Also infrastructure. I mean, what kind of computers do they have? What kind of electrical system do they have? You know, I mean,
yep.
It's a different environment.
Yeah, it is, although it's, you know, it's that's starting to change. And, you know, one of the decisions that we made early on in the project was to, you know, was to go with a web-based application model, you know, where you have one centralized server and everybody accesses it through a browser. And that means that you have to have internet connectivity. Exactly. In addition to having just basics like power, and you hit it on the head. I mean, particularly where the branches are out in rural areas, in a lot of cases, power cuts will happen and the system will go down for 3 hours or 12 hours or something like that. But the infrastructure in a lot of cases is catching up faster than we can get the systems out there. And so the decision that we made was that, you know, until we saturate the market that's got the infrastructure capacity to use a web-based system, we're not going to worry about solving for the offline piece of it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's enough demand out there, and there are enough benefits to being able to deliver the technology that way, and starting to look at hosted models and software as a service models as well to further kind of remove the technology burden off of the MFI.
What about language issues? I mean, is a lot of finance done in English, or do you have to specialize this for all the different languages that might be involved?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the region that you're in. In Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, for example, in most cases, you can get away with supporting the kind of the colonial language, if you will, the, you know, English or French, couple Portuguese speaking countries there, and not have to get down to the level of kind of the local traditional African languages. But one of the other benefits and values that I think that we get out of or hope to get out of an open source community and building this in a way that other people can tack onto it is to make it very easy for language packs to be developed out in the field. You know, so if you've got a guy in Cambodia who's working with an MFI and they need to use it in Khmer, which is something that we're not going to localize for, we need to make it very easy for him to be able to do that, contribute it back in so others can get access to it.
And that is one of the big advantages of open source, is that any piece of customization, you said you got that 90% that you can deliver, but it's that other 10% that really make the difference to really make it a usable application for a particular community's needs.
That's exactly right. And the being able to make that last 10% something that varies wildly by, you know, locality, region, type of MFI, is one of the huge value propositions I think we've got by being open source. You know, we can create that 90%, and that last 10% might be totally different for an MFI in Nepal versus an MFI in Bolivia. And letting those local partners, and there's a great example of it. We've got a partner in Nepal, a company called Magnus Consulting, and a guy named Soham, who's done exactly that. They have a different way of calculating interest. And I forget if that's for regulatory reasons or just kind of the way that things are done. But he was able to go in, modify the code to add this different interest rate calculation, which is what his MFI partner needed, and submit that back into our community so that we can make it available to everybody else. And that has a huge amount of potential.
So you are finding some upstream contributions back that you're accepting and distributing to other areas then?
Yep, some. And you know, somewhat limited at this point. I think one of the things that we keep running up against is how, you know, where are the right places for people to plug in, and how do we need to build the technology to make it easier for them to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pretty niche application. It's not something that a lot of software developers are going to be using themselves. You know, but we have started to see some of them come in, and we've got people in, you know, the guy in Nepal, and we've got somebody in Senegal, and a guy in Nigeria, and a guy down in, I don't know, where's Graham Adam in New Zealand someplace?
New Zealand, yeah.
You know, who are doing things and are active on the mailing list, and, you know, some patches coming back in. We've also had some good fortune with some corporate partners coming in and saying, you know, this is really interesting to us. We've got some developers who work on financial systems. We're going to let them do a bug bash, you know, every couple of months, and spend a day going through your bug list, fixing what they can, and sending that back in.
Cool.
As well, and having those contributions.
And what's your infrastructure like out there? Is it like, I mean, how are these guys paying their paycheck? Is this all supported by NGOs, or are they actually making a profit off of the financial transactions, or what?
Do you mean the MFIs themselves, or the local partners who are working with them?
Yeah, I'm kind of looking at all the levels. I'll get to you in a second, but I'm just sort of wondering about how these guys out in the field are justifying taking this open source software and retooling it. They obviously have to make a living to do that, or they're, you know,
absolutely somehow. Absolutely. And so they are looking at ways to, you know, to charge deployment service fees, for example, or, you know, if they're offering it in a hosted model, you know, do they charge a subscription fee for the particular version that they've put together? So certainly the local technology partners, the only way that this is going to work and get to scale is if there is a sound business model for those local technology partners to be able to service MFIs and support MFIs effectively. There's no question about that. I think that there in the near term, there's a huge role for philanthropic capital to pay to help seed that market and be able to demonstrate to these guys that there is, in fact, a viable market there and a viable business for them to pursue.
And so these people are typically like one level removed then from the actual microbanks then, because they're providing services to the banks.
Yeah, they're kind of, you know, they're kind of like a VAR or an SI, you know, that is a technology partner working with this MFI to get their technology solution in place.
Do you have anybody that's like the bank themselves is doing their own customization and design?
We haven't seen many. You know, Grameen Kuda in Bangalore, which is our biggest client, they have done a lot of things on their own, and they go in and they, you know, they run scripts straight against the database, the underlying database, and they, you know, they're able to write their own reports using the reporting system that's in there and kind of dig around. But most of these microfinance institutions don't have developers on staff. You know, they're you know, they're lucky if they've got a good IT guy on staff or a good IT staff in place. And so that's where I think there's so much value in building up this ecosystem of local technology providers who can partner up with the MFIs to be able to figure out what they need, and then come back into the community with, hey, you know, this is what half of the people that we're talking to look like they need. How do we get this designed and put into the system?
How much of it is hosted? I would imagine that would be very valuable for some of these users.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's one of the key strategies that I think we have as an initiative going forward is finding ways to get it hosted for more and more MFIs.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to figure out how to do that in a way that allows them to tailor it to their own business processes, which is
each installation is very customized.
Yeah, and what customized means for us so far, you know, not customized at a code level, although I expect there to be some of those, but we've built the system to be really highly configurable.
Right.
You know, and Soham in Nepal, you know, I think in the initial stages of working on the deployment, and he's run into some infrastructure challenges with the MFIs he's working with, but it essentially was a custom system where he built the custom interest rate configuration that's now shipped in the last two releases, and so he can go back to being on the main code tree.
Right. I'm just looking at the manual. You obviously have to write that for a variety of users, but do you focus on the kind of the value added guys who will come in and help, or do you actually provide end user support also?
We're talking to a couple of the institutions who are using the software now about providing them with some direct support services.
Wow.
And
that's
we have
to be a challenge. Wow.
Yeah, it is. Although the ones who have got, and some of the bigger MFIs who have got substantial IT staffs, and Grameen Kuda and you know, one of the other ones we work with, Enda in Tunisia, both have that. They've got fairly capable IT staffs in place, and so we can do that support from a distance.
Yeah.
For the smaller MFIs and the less sophisticated ones, we will, I think, look for ways to be backup support to the local partner.
Right. Right.
But part of these support offerings and things is also a way for us to start to find revenue streams that we can use to drive our own financial sustainability.
Yeah, how are you funded now?
Yeah, to date we've been funded almost exclusively through philanthropic donations. People coming in, and we've had individuals who have come in and looked at what we've done and said, "Wow, this is very cool. I made a bunch of money in the tech sector. Let me help you out." As well as some institutional and foundation help. We've started just in the last quarter or so generating some fee for service revenue, you know, through these support contracts or through professional services. And for us to be sustainable and for us to get to scale over the long term, building up those revenue streams to supplement and, you know, eventually hopefully overtake the philanthropic donations will be important.
Yeah. Mm. How expensive is it to do this? Do you have a big team? It doesn't sound like your typical open source project. Sounds like it's a little bit more organized. if that's not the right word, I don't know.
Hey.
I don't know. You join some of our team meetings and you might disagree. But now we've got a pretty good sized team, and we've grown a lot over the last year. When I started managing the project, it was about 2.5 years ago, and there were three of us working on this, and the thought of trying to build a globally applicable enterprise class financial application in an open source model with three people, not so much.
Yeah.
And so we're up to, we've got about 14, 15 people on the team right now, about half of which are product development and half of which are doing other things, including working directly on deployments and doing biz dev work and things like that. But it is, I mean, you hit it right. It's a very expensive proposition. Because it's not, you know, it's not the type of open source project that you can kind of plant a seed and throw it out into the wild and let it germinate. It's going to take a lot more structure and a lot more support.
That's
from us.
The word I was looking for is structured. Exactly. Yeah.
There you go.
You can't rely on volunteers so much.
No, you really can't. And that means both building up our capacity, finding ways to build the community, you know, both with volunteers, with these corporate partnerships, you know, those I think play a very substantial role. And then finding the, you know, the partners and the dev shops out in the regions where microfinance is happening, who can see a business here for them to get into and write some code as part of a deployment they're getting paid to do, contribute that back in, and kind of get the value out of the community that way.
So do you ultimately see this as a for-profit venture?
I don't. You know, it's something that we've looked at, and, you know, because in some ways we, you know, as an open source project, we look, you know, more like a Compeer or a Sugar CRM than
we do,
you know, an Apache or something like that.
It's an enterprise level. Great.
Yeah. And the reality is that what we're trying to do has a very deep social purpose. And generating the level of kind of equity investment that would be needed to make this a truly for-profit venture, I think is larger than maybe than what's realistic. And it also starts to close some doors down. It's a lot easier as a nonprofit initiative, particularly a nonprofit open source initiative, to be able to go out and get the partnerships and even work with other vendors in the same domain to say, we're all trying to solve the same problem here. Let's go out and work on this together. Let's go to IBM and talk to them about how we get them involved. And they're going to be a lot more amenable and a lot more open to that if it doesn't, you know, have this this taste of, well, are you guys just trying to make a buck off of us by some free resources?
You know, I'm already thinking at home now. I bet people listening to this show are already, there's probably like 30 people are already saying, that sounds really cool. I want to work on that. Because, you know, it does have this sort of motivation of just being something that is socially motivated.
Yeah. Makes a difference.
It's making a difference.
Absolutely.
Now, having said that, you said you've got 14 or 15 people working with you. Are you looking for more assistance? And if so, what technical skill and what knowledge domain do they need?
Yep, absolutely. And we do. And I think getting people involved, there are lots of different ways to get involved. And writing code is one of them, but it's not the only one. And in fact, you know, I think we have some work to do. And Adam, you can speak to this as well on the technology front to make it easier for somebody to come in who only has time to spend a couple hours a week. You know, it's a complex system. You know, things like language packs and things like kind of extensions around the edges are probably the best way to contribute there. But even getting in and just learning about what's going on, or, you know, getting the system installed and trying to help answer questions when, you know, some guy in some random part of the world goes, I can't figure out how to open a savings account. Even that is useful. Doing QA on the system, and we've got some information up on the website on different places where people can poke at that is useful as well. But Adam, I know you've thought a lot about this as well. Is there anything you want to?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, earlier we mentioned that, you know, you can't really count on volunteers, and it's true. I mean, we need to have an internal infrastructure that's just set and ready to accept contributions. Really recently, there's this Pentaho released this Beekeeper document. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but really talks about a really cool concept of leading an open source project as beekeepers, such that you're just kind of tending to the hive and you're doing infrastructure type Hy-V type of operations, right. And then you're helping the bees do their job. But really, they're the ones you want to do all your work. So the better you build your infrastructure, obviously, the better they can.
And if you steal their honey, they're going to sting you to death.
Absolutely, yeah, it's something to look out for. And they, so we're finding that we need to go a little further than just so. Translation is a good example. You talked about how can MFIs localize into their own language? Well, it's not that hard. I mean, there's plain text files, and then there's just key value pairs, and you change the value, and that changes the translated string. But it's harder. It's just enough of a hump for most people not to want to do it. And so we found that we had to make an online translation tool, and so that'll be launching shortly.
Just to make it easier, so they can work online, and they don't have to worry about how it's getting incorporated.
Exactly. And it'll give them help as far as like how much has been translated so far, fuzzy matching, and kind of this dictionary inside of it. So it really helps you do translations.
As long as we've got you, we're talking to you, Adam. Tell us a little bit about the technical details. What is this written in? Is it designed for the web only? Is it?
Yeah, it's Java. It's basically web only right now, although we've always talked about, you know, other types of interfaces. So it's capable to do, you know, Java is really big on that kind of infrastructure in terms of, you know, allowing all the stuff to connect, as you know. So, right now it's just web only Java.
So would you run Apache? How would you, what server software would you be running?
The easiest way to get started is just to install a Tomcat. Servlet engine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you run the software. In fact, you sent us, I don't know if we can give it out, we'll put in the show notes, a test server so people could actually see what it looks like. Is that available to the public, or? Or do you prefer to keep that private?
Oh, I don't.
No, it is. It's actually linked to off of our website up on mephos.org. So
people can see what it's like, what it looks like, how it feels, how it runs.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, and Adam, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think there's both a demo server with the current, you know, released version, as well as a test server that has the development bits on it.
That's correct.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and so some of the infrastructure is, that's the part I'm most interested in, is kind of community involvement and the infrastructure it takes. Because I thought, you know, I just come into this open source project and I just get to write all the open source, you know, write all the free software and open source code. And and it's really not like that at all. It's really like I feel like now I stepped into a role where all I do is set up infrastructure, and I really find that rewarding because the people that actually do the contributions, they're like, oh, I just helped end world poverty just a little bit.
Right.
Wow. And so that I guess is kind of one of the more rewarding things, is like see them start to take over and do the right thing for other contributors.
Sure. And as a facilitator, even, you're magnifying your actions. So that's, it must be very satisfying to do this.
That's right. More honey in the hive.
Yeah. It's not so bad being a beekeeper.
No, not at all. Yeah, my dad was. Yeah.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Well, you come by it honestly. Do you have the funny hat?
He did have the funny hat.
You need that. It's very important. Yeah. Very important. Well, that's cool. Yeah. I know that you need to run along, George, so I don't want to keep you.
Absolutely. No, it's been a pleasure and appreciate the time. And we'll leave Adam here with you to kind of dig into more of the details.
George Kennard runs the MIFOS project, MIFOS, M-I-F-O-S .org. And thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And we're going to keep the beekeeper online.
Yes. All right. Talk about bees.
Well, we could talk, we talked at a higher level about the issues involved, but we can talk a little bit more about implementation and so forth, because Adam, you're faced with that day in, day out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, I mean, just kind of the different tools you need to collaborate. I mean, I guess you really need effective use of version control, of course. And
which one do you use? Do you use SVN, Git? What do you?
We use SVN. I love Git, but that's where we're on now. Yeah. And SVN merge is actually a critical tool we need to use to layer on top of Subversion, because we're still using 1.4. Okay. And so it makes merging. Yes.
Randall, that was just a little too candid.
Well,
we did a show on Git. Now we're all about Git. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, me too. That's the show that convinced me to look at it as well, actually.
Oh, really?
Very good. Yeah, so you've been a listener to the show for a while then, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
And actually, I should say that these guests, both of them, Adam came to me and said, I want to be a guest on the show.
Oh,
so.
Very good. Well, thank you, Adam, for joining us. It's really good. And you're right. This is such a, every open source project has kind of the glow of holiness about it, because you're doing something altruistic. You're helping people. You get to write code, but you're kind of giving it back to the community. But this is an extra layer of, altruism, because it's not only giving back, but you're really helping people all over the world.
We hope so. Yeah. That's the goal. Yeah. I mean, we really believe, Muhammad Yunus, one of his quotes was that basically one day our grandchildren would go to museums to see what poverty was like.
Oh, let's hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. He really believes that we can end world poverty. That's just kind of a radical thing. But I came for Floss, actually. I came to this project because it was free software.
Right.
But now I'm hooked.
So how did you stumble across this? What was your area before, and what were you doing, and what do you, you know, how did that transition to what you're doing now?
Oh, I did mainly web development, e-commerce, a couple different companies, and then ended up aerospace and Linux stuff, and then my wife found this on Craigslist, and I'd been looking.
Adam, you got to get out of the aerospace. We've got a baby on the way. You need to do something more.
That's right.
Yeah. Sure. Is this a full-time job for you, Adam?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's really neat.
And so you're working with some of the other 14 contributors, I guess, or more, I guess, probably. Are they geographically disparate? I mean, are they all over the world?
All over, yeah. Let's see. George mentioned Saham in Nepal. There's a guy named Graham in New Zealand who's been very active. And it's cool because it's not like there are just a handful that can actually develop the code. It's so complex. It's this huge enterprise system. But people like Graham in New Zealand will come at us with have you thought about Tomcat security, or have you thought about having a VPN between your branches and the central office for MFIs, and all this great information that it's not directly coding, but we couldn't live without it. So every contribution is amazingly helpful.
You say there's a big, like a big ball of code that's all complex. I understand you're moving to a system or to a new release that's going to be more test-driven development and things like that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The old system was test-driven, but in a way that's like, if you imagine where you're testing an interface and you test every value that could possibly go through it. So say you make an interface, you make some interface that's like, get value, and you say, get value A, get value B, get value C, and try every value you can think of. It's more, what do you call that? Fuzzing or something, I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
And instead of doing that, we want to do more directed testing, which is like, this is how I think it should work. Here's a sample value. Give me the result that I expect. Okay, that's great. It works. So more directed testing. We could probably have one test for every 10 we have right now. It looks like it was kind of done as code coverage just for the sake of code coverage. So yeah, so less code is a big thing. And on those lines, technologies like Spring and Maven and, it's funny because Ruby on Rails is big into coding by convention rather than and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's some of the newer Java tools are along the same lines. You don't have to write the code as long as you can fit into this framework a little better.
Interesting. And you've been using that?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's worked, has it worked for you? You fit into the convention.
Yeah. Well, yeah. One example would be Maven, the build system, you can have significantly less XML written if you just kind of have your directory set up in a certain way, and then you say, okay, now we want to run acceptance tests to hit our website with an automated thing that'll click through, and then it'll just like set up the container, deploy this thing. One guy on our team, Adam Floyer and Van Medel Henkel, set that up, and it's just awesome. So it makes development go from, you know, waiting for like a half hour build to like doing these 1 minute builds over and over, and just being able to watch it change all within your IDE and such.
Wow. So how does this deploy? Is it like just a big Tomcat installation, and then you have to have what, a MySQL backend for the actual data, something like that?
That's right. MySQL backend, and then you'll basically set up your Tomcat. Tomcat's you can either just it comes with your, say if you have a Linux distribution, it comes with that. On Windows, it's just you just unzip it and get rolling, and you're going to throw a web archive that's built by in the source tree. The build system will build that, and you throw that web archive in there and start up Tomcat, and it just works.
Do you have to make special concessions for reliability, for stability of data, things like that, because of the unusual places you'll be deploying it? I mean, have you paid attention to that kind of stuff?
Not as much as we should have, I guess. It's a little bit, you know, George mentioned Grameen CUDA, and they're especially good at keeping track of what's, you know, adapting to their own business needs and customizing it. Right. And it's tricky, right? It's a good thing that they can get at their own data, because sometimes they need to while we're still, you know, churning and in development and such. Right. But
so they have the skills to write scripts around it and so forth. You're lucky to be.
They are amazingly talented. Yeah.
Do they get, how much feedback? What's the feedback loop between you and them in the development cycle?
Well, they're in particular, that particular MFI has so much information for us that we have one person at least dedicated to talking with them.
So they're the customer, really, in a way, for this job.
Absolutely, yeah. And we send people on site to work with them directly, and some of the things, you know, you get so much over Skype and such, and IRC and mailing lists, but to see it in person, there's nothing like face to face, even with all the tools we have.
Are the frameworks you're using helping you in that regard too? I know that's one of the real selling points of Ruby on Rails is the quick turnaround time with clients. You know, you can say, well, let me see how that works. Do you have that kind of flexibility with the tools you're using on Java?
That's a good question. You know, and especially since the newer tools we just started using more recently haven't been production tested yet. Uh-huh. But there's no reason why that wouldn't be the case. I mean, I think you could imagine, okay, now the change you're describing is just more of a module that you plug in you can try out a different kind of, George mentioned, different kind of interest calculation, right? So maybe that could be an interest calculation module that you plug in and try. So yeah, totally. I could.
And it may be in financial services. You don't want to be as loosey-goosey as you might be if you're designing a web application for, you know.
Right.
It's probably true that this rapid application development may not be exactly suited for this. You know.
How much of this code has to be reviewed then by financial bank overseers
regulators,
to make sure the code is audited properly and can audit the transactions properly?
I can't speak to any of that, unfortunately. I
don't know. Like you don't want to say, or you just don't
well, who
know?
Knows what the reg? You know,
you
don't.
Leave it. I'll leave it.
You're not running it by U.S. regulators at this point. You're running it by I don't know what. I mean, I presume that the implementers are going to have to make sure.
You know,
that
we actually, we have a guy, Keith Pierce, that worked at the Fed.
Really?
That knows a lot about that kind of stuff, and is also a mathematician and software architect, and so we defer him. We ask him those kind of questions.
Well, let me say, all of those MIT graduates who spent all of their cycles in the last 10 years creating derivatives, here's your chance to make up for it by doing something.
Your penance
is to go to work for MIFOS, use your brains for good instead of evil. And help get us out of this mess that you guys created.
It's addictive. Yeah, you guys should Try it for sure.
That's really neat. That's really.
I'm just thinking back to Office Space and a salami attack or something. I'm just, you know, just want to make sure that's not in there somewhere for these poor the developing countries. It's pretty horrible.
On a more personal note, you're expecting you and your wife are expecting a baby any day now, yeah?
That's right. Eva and I are very excited.
Oh, she's that's great.
And you got to point that out, Adam and Eva.
Oh my God. So the baby, Cain, Abel, what are you going to...
Oh, boy.
No. Oh, no, great I'm just kidding. No, I'm just teasing. So that's exciting. Is she a programmer? How is it that she chose this job for you?
Eva is a programmer, yeah. She's a mathematician and a software engineer programmer and a lot smarter than I am. She helps me with my homework.
That's great. That's really great. That's neat. I think she must have said, hey, this would be a good thing for us to work on because it's such a good project for the world.
Yeah, she was tired of me complaining about wanting to write free software and not being able to, and so she started scouring Craigslist. And
what a great project. That's so neat. You must love it.
I owe it all to Eva, that's for sure.
Well, good luck to both of you, and do you know if it's a boy or a girl? Are you going to be surprised?
It's going to be a girl.
Congratulations. It's good to start with the girl. we started with a girl first, and that worked out well.
Oh, good news.
At least so far.
Well, thank you so much for having us on, man. This has been incredibly fun, and I've been a longtime fan of the show.
Our great pleasure, Adam. And thank you for bringing this to our attention, because this is a really neat project. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right on.
Yeah, Mifos, MIFOS.org. Adam Monson, thanks for joining us on Floss Weekly. So, Adam and George and Mifos. Randall, you get bonus points for altruism this week.
Good, because I could use those points in a lot of ways.
Kiwi Nerd saying in our chat room, I never thought he added in him. I have to rethink now my entire opinion of Randall Schwartz.
I have my spectrum, though. I have my highs and my lows.
That's why we love you, obvious. Randall. Yeah, we love you, because you're a character. Well, yeah. This is really an interesting subject. It just, you know, what I love about this, it shows how broad... the range of open source projects can be. We've talked about open source enterprise software before, and Sugar CRM, of course, and others. But here's a really great example of banking software, open source, but also doing such a great thing with this micro lending.
And it just really, you know, the depth of this is just really amazing. I mean, when I started doing the research for today's show, and I really started reading in depth what this project is about and how, you know, they're taking, you know, $100 loans or $10 loans, you know, and saying, here, pay this back in a month or a week or whatever, and making that work. And, you know, to have to go out and, you know, pay for, you know, closed source proprietary solutions to make this work, it just
doesn't
wouldn't
make sense
for them.
Doesn't make sense.
Because the overhead has to be low to make these things really work. And and also just, you know, yes, my experience in open source software for all these years has been, you know, commercial enterprise, you know. So for me to start looking at social change organizations using open source software, you know, I see a lot of that in Brazil because I see that the government and everybody stepping up to the open source platter and really making that work for them there. You know, I can see some of that, but just to be this direct that you know, Adam writes a line of code that, you know, 3 months later enables a woman to get a box of yarn so she can make a shirt to sell a week later and pay off the loan.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
I mean, direct that, you know, this code being written has having that kind of immediate impact on changing the way the world is. It's just, it's moving. It truly is moving.
Well, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, open source is kind of altruistic anyway. I mean, in order to do open source, you kind of have to suspend your notion of I'm only in it for the money and start to think about higher reasons to do what you do. And the neat thing about open source is that still can work for you. You could still make a living. You could, you know, there's still, it doesn't mean becoming a monk.
No.
But it is ultimately, I think open source is kind of comes from that point of view of being, doing good.
Well, I've got to say, I was inspired by this. I wanted to go help him. I mean, if I knew anything about Java.
Yeah. No kidding.
And if I didn't have a lot of other things that have to get paid this month, I would go do that. So
well, now it makes me think, I bet you there are other areas where open source could be of help in other, you know, do-gooder organizations. I mean, maybe even just going down to your local Big Brothers Big Sisters and making a database for them so they can keep track of who's who. There's got to be a lot of places where somebody with some technological skills can help out.
Ooh, that would be interesting to set up some sort of overall project. And of course, luckily, one of our readers or one of our listeners is going to email me and go, "That's already been set up. It's called this."
Right,
have some sort of project where technology people can offer services directly to the community organizations, the NGOs of their local community, even. So, well,
and there are websites for volunteering and where they are say, "Hey, we're looking for volunteers." In fact, we've been publicizing those for years. Let me just see if I can. Off the top of my head, I think it's Volunteer Match. Yeah, volunteermatch.org.
Okay.
Where you could volunteer. And I bet you, I mean, it's not specific, not exclusively programmers, but I bet you somebody with technical skills, whether it's, you know, setting up a network, making a printer work, getting Windows to work, or writing software, could find somebody that needs you. And
well, we have this wonderful recycling store in Portland called Free Geek. Which takes old computer systems and gives them just enough new goo and stuff in them and has Saturday clinics where people can come down and find out how to install open source software on them and how to get, you know, help with stuff. It's just
great.
You know, Portland's like that kind of a community anyway. So we're kind of, I'm sure there's places in the Bay Area that are like that, but here in Portland, it's really sort of in the culture to really have that kind of sharing and stuff going on. I mean, obviously we're, you know, we were biased towards Obama and everything. I'm really happy about the election and all that too. And I think this is going to happen as a result of, you know, our new presidential setup. You know, I think we're going to see a lot more of the need for things like MIFOS and open source sponsoring and helping, you know, because it's going to be some rough times ahead, and what we can do to, you know, to help that all across. I'm sure it's going to be really interesting.
Let's all pull together,
absolutely,
and help each other. And that's a really great thing about open source.
Mm-hmm.
Randall, not to change the subject, but let me change the subject.
Okay,
what's coming up on Floss Weekly?
Well, if you go to the spreadsheet, which is linked from twit.tv/floss, you see that coming up next week, the day before Thanksgiving, I'm glad he offered to do this, I've got an old acquaintance of mine. I don't know how old he is. He's not, he might not be that old.
An ancient acquaintance.
I have an acquaintance
Long-time acquaintance.
Joe Zonker Bronkmeyer. I've worked with him on various projects over the years. He was, in fact, the editor-in-chief of Linux Magazine for at least a while I was writing for Linux Magazine. Okay. So we've been a fellow columnist together on that earlier in that. Well, he wrote and offered, actually somebody offered him to speak about OpenSUSE because he is on the OpenSUSE project. So
good. We need to do more Linux stuff. I'm told that all the time. You need to do more Linux stuff.
I know you're told that all the time. And I keep saying there's a lot more to Floss than Linux.
Linux is great. We love Linux, but we talk about all open source. And I know, you know, a number of people said, "Why aren't you doing a Linux only show?" And I just don't want to limit it to Linux only.
There's so much more out there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't really want to do a tips show. There are lots of very good Linux tips shows and how to use Linux and Linux software. So I think I'd like to support open source in general. But good, we'll talk about OpenSUSE.
Yeah,
which is actually one of my favorite Linux distributions. So that's
and the week following, we're going to talk with Peter Saint-André about Jobber and XMPP, which you're a big fan of.
Yeah, in fact, I've been looking forward to talking to Peter. Peter's a part of the XMPP committee, and I really want to ask him about open microblogging. I like to call it open micromessaging. XMPP seems like the backbone for that kind of thing, and I know he wrote a very interesting specification for it. Open micro messaging, and so we'll talk. That'll be very fun to talk about that. So
that's
a couple of weeks hence, after Thanksgiving.
Exactly, and the day after this show comes out, it'll be my 47th birthday. So I'm just going to say happy birthday to me.
Happy birthday! That's great. Congratulations. Yep. That's wonderful.
And this is the 47th show, which is really bizarre. So there we go. How did that work out?
I don't know. That's very scary. All right, Randall. Hey, we really appreciate all the great work you've done, and you made this show so much more fun.
Thank you.
And weekly, which is pretty amazing. We did miss you on the cruise. We're glad you're back.
Thanks.
And how's the arm? I forgot to ask.
Well, it's been throbbing for the last hour.
Okay.
So I've had.
Are you in a cast? Are you in a sling? How is that?
I'm in the removable sling. I got put in that yesterday. Good. They took off the one that was right after the surgery, so I got to see my stitches and stuff for the first time. And
did that make your butt tingle?
It was a little weird, and I also got to see the X-ray of the monster-sized plate they put in my arm.
Wow.
Oh, no wonder I'm having trouble even moving my fingers and stuff. I mean, I'm basically in constant pain right now, which doesn't help
sorry.
A whole lot.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's life. It's okay, though. You know, as long as I can type with one hand, I'm going to keep doing this project. I'm going to keep doing everything I have to
Thank
do.
You.
So
yeah.
there we go.
And,
you know,
and even go on cruises, because this man, you know, no matter what, he's not. He's yeah. going to be out there. He's going to be doing it. Even if he's hurt, he's going to go yeah. on that cruise.
Absolutely. Well, that and get Floss Weekly moving and also run my business. So, yeah.
Thank you, Randall. You could find Randall if you want to give him some business, help support him, supporting us with Floss Weekly by going to Stonehenge.com. Yeah, that's Stonehenge. He's the original.
Yes, exactly.
Stonehenge.com.
Thanks.
Randall Schwartz. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.